The mics are live. That's always a scary thought. Okay, I am Commissioner Brian Crotchus. Good morning, everyone. This is an update from SPP, and then we have another one this afternoon from MISO. Joining me, Commissioner Julie Fedorchak and Commissioner Randy Christman. And I don't have any opening comments. And let's see, SPP would be Randy. So do you have any
opening comments? No, thanks.
Commissioner Christman, and then we'll have the four people at the table identify themselves, too, just for the
I don't really have much of anything to add. I'll turn it over to the SPP folks and let them present things. But Victor and I have been attending quarterly meetings, and we had a special meeting in Dallas in May. Welcome to North Dakota, gentlemen, and we welcome you with a little smaller table than we have at our SPP meetings. It always seems odd to me to have these tables where I can hardly distinguish who's at the far end of them, but good to have you here, and we'll turn it over to you guys, unless Victor has something initially to...
And then I believe, Julie, you have something.
She changed her mind. Just one quick thing. I appreciate you guys being here, first of all. Brian and I don't have as much of an opportunity to engage on SPP as Randy, and so we've got a small commission staff, and we have the luxury of getting to work with two RTOs, so that's an extra challenge for us, but we're up to it. These have been dubbed an update, and I feel like that kind of puts the burden on you guys to provide information, but I don't really view it that way. I see it more as a conversation and an opportunity for us to visit about the pertinent issues. So thanks for bringing us information, and know that at least I view it more conversational and as an opportunity to really talk. So okay. Thanks.
Well, I appreciate that. I'm Sam Loudenslager with Southwest Power Pool. I'm the Director of Regulatory Policy there for the company. And I've got Lee Elliott with me, who's also in the regulatory department. And then one of the efforts that we started with our market monitoring unit, I guess about a year or so ago, is when we got the opportunity, we would check with the MMU and see if they had time and would like to come visit the commission with us to give the commissioners an opportunity to understand kind of what the market monitor does and how they're structured and all that kind of stuff. And I've got Greg Sorensen, he can introduce himself when I finish up my side. I'm going to take about an hour for my end of the conversation and then hand it off to Greg to do his MMU stuff, okay? So I appreciate the opportunity to be here. The rain or the hail woke me up during the night. I don't know what it was, but one of the two, and it came in sheets, it seemed like. So you've seen this before. SPP, our mission is to help our members work together to keep the lights on today and in the future. And this is the way that we do all of our business. We see ourselves mainly as facilitators. We may take an issue to the members, or the members may bring an issue to us, or the regulators or the stakeholders will bring an issue to us. And we just try to work together to come to a reasonable solution. But at the end of the day, it's always to keep the lights on. That's the bottom line. Go ahead, Lee. So one of the things you guys understand, because y'all have been with the commission for a while now, is that the grid today is not our parents' grid. It's not my grid. It's the grid that involves all sorts of things. You've now got things called prosumers, which are entities that produce energy and consume energy at the same time. Distributed generation, microgrids, all of these things go into helping us understand kind of the grid and issues that we have to deal with when we're planning for the grid. This is the SPP region, new map, but y'all are familiar with this. Go ahead. And the role of the grid operator, on the left-hand side of this picture, you see the resources, and on the right-hand side is where you see the load. And I was wondering, when I first saw this is new to me. When I first saw it, I was like, so where are the batteries? And then I realized, oh, it's that little charging thing over there by the car, I guess is a representative of a battery. But this kind of, I think, does a pretty good job of graphically showing how the grid has changed, how, you know, you've got nukes, you've got coal, you've got hydro, solar, wind, kind of everything on that side, and even the side on the load side, things are changing. And again, our role is to make sure we provide the most economic resource to load. Okay. You've seen this before. It's changed a little bit. On the left-hand side is kind of our resource mix in terms of the portfolio of resources our members have. And on the right-hand side is what was actually consumed, produced for consumption. And this is last year, I believe. Yeah. So coal continues to shrink in terms of being utilized as part of the portfolio, but it's still a cheap resource in our region, and our members continue to want to see us utilize coal, which is fine. We're resource agnostics. We just need to make sure we can use whatever resources are made available to get out to meet demand. Okay.
Do you, with the percent of coal as a capacity shrinking, mm-hmm. but it's used still
quite a bit.
Quite a bit. Do you get concerned that if it keeps shrinking, you won't have it for use?
I don't think that's going to happen for quite a while. I can't tell you.
Based on retirements?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. When you say quite a while, what's your opinion on?
Well, I'll retire in 2 years. It'll still be there in 2 years.
Right. That's all you care about.
But no, sorry for the smart comment. I don't know. I mean, I see it
you're
in a research.
You're just honest. Putting it in,
aren't you? Victor and I are used to it.
I see it in our resource mix probably for the next 10 years anyway. I don't see that changing much. And who knows? I mean, we may come up with a technology may come up with a better way to utilize coal. I don't know. So
at this percentage, you see it in your resource mix, or you just think it'll be part of it?
I think it'll be part of it. Yeah, I think that will continue to shrink. That 29% will continue to decrease over time. Will it ever go to zero? I don't know. I doubt it.
And then what fills in, though, with a 40?
Well, what you would imagine. It'll be gas, wind, solar, storage, all that new stuff, right, that's not so new anymore. But, okay. So we've got 98 members right now. We've got, I think since I was here last, I think I was here in, like, December or January, we've added two large retail customers to our membership. Walmart joined last fall, and Google recently joined in this month, I guess, is when it was. I think you're seeing entities like that participating more and more in RTOs across the country.
Where do they fit in those? In that?
They're the bottom one, the two large tail retail customers.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
How much does it cost for them to be members?
Right now it's $6,000 as an annual membership fee.
And what do they get in terms of
the right
voice?
To vote.
Okay.
Full participation in our stakeholder process and the right to vote. It's our way to make sure that people that are voting on issues actually have some skin in the game, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
We are talking about probably increasing that $6,000, but nothing's been decided at this point.
So doubling it or?
Tripling, I don't know. Oh. It'll be a significant increase from $6,000.
It's everybody pays the same, though?
Yes.
Okay. So 98 votes.
Hmm?
98 votes total right now.
Mm-hmm.
So 50 corporations spent $300,000.
Mm-hmm.
They could significantly influence the
Sure, vote. Absolutely. And our Markets and Operations Policy Committee, that's the one committee where every member has a vote, and that's one of our major committees that dictates kind of policy and dictates direction on technical issues. So everybody at the table gets a vote.
And is the vote an advisory vote, or
no.
What does the vote do?
Well, it's advisory. Ultimately, it is, but typically the board will take the vote, the outcome of a Markets and Operations Policy Committee vote, and just
implement
accept
that.
It, you know. So...
But if there was a coup in place or something like that, 50 more companies come in and spend $300,000 to do something disruptive or something like that, the board would not be obligated to
no.
accepting that.
No. Yeah, I mean, the board's independent, right? So they've got the option to do what they think is in the best interest of the company. And they've done that historically. At one point, with our previous board chair, every issue that the Markets and Operations Policy Committee would take up and vote on, they would have to, the board it then in turn would take up every one of those issues. And now basically they've got a consent agenda where everything pops up on the consent agenda. They can take things off that consent agenda, or somebody can request that they take it off, and it's up to the board to make that decision. Have you ever attended one of our board and RSC meetings?
Nope. No, not SPP.
Really like to get you over there, just see how the process works, because it's a lot different than the MISO process.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like it.
A lot different. I mean, yeah. Mm-hmm. Like Randy said, you'll go into the meetings, and I think Paul Suske's described this for you. and you've got a U-shaped table, the biggest room we can find, and a hotel, and a big hotel, and you'll have 98 people sitting around that table or in the row behind that table. And then you've probably got another 75, 80 of your closest friends in the room, too. So we'll have 200 people attend these MOPC meetings. At the board meeting, it's a little less attendance, about 125, 130. But the same setup. The board sits around the table with the regional state committee. They sit at the table together and take care of their business that they have in common. So.
And the regional state committee is one of the MOPC members.
No, but they participate.
So there's
staff,
8 of them.
Mm-hmm.
8 votes.
Yeah, but the RSC doesn't participate in MOPC. They've got staff there that are paying attention, because keep in mind there's a difference in OMS and the regional state committee. The regional state committee has some very distinct areas that it has responsibility for. And those are the areas that it follows and the staff for the states follow. One of the primary one being cost allocation, right? So whenever those issues or cost allocation issues that come forward, MOPC may or may not take a vote on the issue, and the RSC may or may not pay any attention to what that vote is, because at the end of the day, whatever the RSC adopts and approves for cost allocation, resource adequacy, and a couple of other items, we have an obligation as SPP to make a filing at FERC to make those changes to our tariff, okay? The board has always approved the recommendations of the RSC, but the board, because it is independent, also has the ability to take a different direction. When that happens, you wind up with 2 filings at FERC on the same issue. That's never happened. Thank goodness.
The RSC is the group that I'm on. And yeah. One commissioner from each state except Nebraska. It's that power review board and
right.
State commission that has it.
Right. So, let's see. This is our board of directors. We've got 2 new ones. It would be Susan Sertoma and Darcy Ortiz. Darcy is a VP with Intel, and Susan Sertoma is in the financial industry. Mainly working with IT companies, okay. 2 of our long-serving board members, Jim Eckelberger and Harry Skilton, are in emeritus status right now. And Larry Altenbaumer is our chair, who came on board last year as the chair. He's been a member of the board for a long time. Our board doesn't have any age limits, nor do they have any term limits. So, okay.
And who picks them?
The members committee.
The 98 members.
The members committee is a representative committee of the different sectors. So if you look at that breakdown of who our membership is, members committee are made up of folks from each of those sectors, okay? I don't know if it's like the advisory committee with MISO or something. I don't know. I don't know enough about MISO.
It's like it's similar anyway.
So next is our regional state committee. Kim O'Gwen is president of the RSC this year. She is with the Arkansas Commission. She's an environmental engineer. Dennis Grinnan, I am assuming, will take over the president's spot next year. He's with the Nebraska Power Review Board. And then Christy Feagan with South Dakota will be in line in 2021. The new member here on the RSC came on board in January to replace a long-serving commissioner, Pat Lyons, And the new member is Jefferson Bird, Jeff Bird. He's also an environmental engineer. So, and this is the cost allocation working group is a working group made up solely of state commission staff people. And there's one representative from each commission that votes on the issues that come before the cost allocation working group. Their recommendations then will go to the RSC for consideration and vote. And Victor, he's kind of turned into kind of one of the old hands now, because he's been around quite a bit. The new guy on the block with the CAWG is John Reynolds from New Mexico. And the lady that had been the New Mexico rep took another position at a utility, and John stepped in. All right. So we're going to go through some of these statistics pretty quick is my plan. We'll see how it goes. Go ahead. So this is a map of our transmission map of our region. You've seen that before. This is the investment that SPP has directed since 2005. Those investments really started taking off once the FERC approved the RSC recommended regional state, or highway byway cost allocation methodology. And you see that it peaked back in around 2014 in terms of plant and service, and we're about to see the end of that big investment period for our region, which makes sense. I mean, you're going to only invest up to a certain point, and then it's not economic for you to continue to do that. We continue to do mostly reliability projects, and I haven't been paying attention. I don't know what's coming out of the planning process next year for board consideration. I don't know if it's an economic project, or I just don't know.
So, when you say reliability, are you talking about to alleviate congestion, or?
No, that would be an economic project.
Right.
So if you need, I don't know.
Just aging infrastructure?
Yeah, just something, replacing something, or if you got a new load somewhere that you need to try to serve, that's all for reliability stuff, okay? Aging infrastructure is kind of an ongoing thing. We always have reliability projects, but they're nothing like some of the large economic projects that we've done in the past.
How is SPP approaching the issue of bringing on, like, having availability for whoever wants to serve and sell into the market, and maybe your existing infrastructure still has capacity, maybe it doesn't. Have you looked at how long you have capacity with your existing infrastructure and what you do as a market provider to make room for new, even if it's not needed?
Well, we can, like I said, we continue to do our planning every year to see kind of what's new that needs to come on board and what needs to be replaced. In terms of generation resources, we're really long. We've probably got 25%, 30% generation capacity in our region right now. So,
but,
and I don't know if I'm answering your question or not.
I'm not. I might not be asking it very clearly. There's plenty of renewables out there to meet the demand for that type of resource.
Yep.
But yet there's more that wants to be added to the market.
Yep.
If your infrastructure can't, if there isn't room for it, or the upgrades need to be made to the infrastructure, how do you, as the market provider, determine, no, we're not going to build any more transmission because the resource isn't needed to meet demand. We have enough
we can't do that.
Right.
So
you said we aren't going to build any more infrastructure because it won't be economic, but that's not really
your decision,
is it?
So let's use the wind farm example. If the wind farm wants to provide service to a specific load, then it'll be incumbent on them to pick up the cost for connecting to the system and doing whatever kind of facility improvements need to be done in order for them to deliver that product, okay?
And is that always a clear decision versus now the backbone needs to be bigger?
I think I see them as two different things, actually. One's, a wind generator can try to serve load. There's cost associated with that, right? Or they can just say, you know what, we're just going to sell into the market, and we don't want to make any major transmission investments. And they can do that, too, if that's what the market, once you run your security-constrained economic dispatch and all, if it shows that that's the best resource to deliver to load. Now, to your point, there's congestion from our west to our east, so it may or may not be deliverable. So,
but isn't that where some of the problems have developed, though, where people come in, they set something up, we're just going to sell in the market. And the next one, we're just going to sell in the market. Suddenly, we've got a transmission system that's overloaded and beyond capacity. And so, well, now we have to upgrade this. Mm-hmm. And so they didn't actually pay it.
So one of the things that you're pointing to is that's one of the issues that, Holistic Integrated Tariff Team has been working on for the last year. And I'll hit those at a high level, kind of some of those issues. Huh? What?
You said you'll hit
those. Hit those, yeah, hit those.
Going back to my, and they both have, both Randy and Julie continued down the path, I think. I'm just trying to, when I think of like the MISO MVP projects, I think the 17 projects that were to alleviate congestion, but also specifically to allow new generation to come online. So how you're classifying your reliability projects can be very broad, but it's not, just so I'm understanding this, has nothing to do with new generation.
Not really. I mean, we try to get, what our planners will do when they go in and they run our integrated transmission plan is they will try to get information that they know about in terms of where the resources are located and where they anticipate that they will be located. And they put all that in their mix when they run their models to see what kind of projects are actually going to be needed and if they're needed for reliability or if they're needed for economics, one of the two. So, and we run that now. We used to be a three-year process. Now it's a one-year process because you'll see in another slide, we got more resources in our generation interconnection queue than will be built. A lot of that's speculative, but even having said that, some of it will be built, and most of that's wind, and what we're also seeing coming online now is solar and storage. Solar has just kind of exploded in our footprint, so we'll run into some of the same issues that we did with wind, I would imagine. So, does that help?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It does.
All right, so speaking of the GIQ, the bar chart on the left-hand side kind of goes over, reflects what's happened with the GIQ since 2013 and how those resources break down. You can see that things kind of exploded both in 16 and 17, and I imagine 18 by the end of the year will be look pretty much like 2017, and that's all driven by the PTC, is in my opinion. If you look on the pie chart on the right-hand side, that breaks down what's currently in our queue. You were asking about coal. Unless there's a technological change, I don't anticipate that we'll see another coal plant built in this country. Mm-hmm. Just for marketplace reasons, it can't make it in the money in the market. So. The things that's really popped up over the last year is, like I said, we've now got 26 gigs of solar in the queue and 5 gigs of storage, which is a lot. And I had assumed that the storage was associated with solar. Some of it is. And I also assumed that meant that those solar requests were probably over in eastern New Mexico, western Texas, which is kind of where some of the best solar is. And what I found out was that's not true. It's every state is seeing storage pop up. I was surprised.
So using your best ability to predict, how much of this do you think actually will make it onto the system?
That's a good question. I would say probably the storage will make it. In terms of solar, we're real new to that. And wind, I doubt half of that will make it onto the system. I'd be surprised if it did. because a lot of that, and you'll know this, PTC is driving a lot of that, and the PTC is expiring. So a lot of that's speculative.
And is this, all of this assumes that any system upgrades are at the cost of the...
Yeah.
The
person, the generator.
Yeah.
Yep. That's correct. So as a...
Now,
yes, sir.
The 5 gigawatts of storage,
mm-hmm.
is that pretty much all battery?
Mm-hmm.
Or are there other things like...
As far as I know,
water up the hill,
no,
run down later.
As far as I know, it's all battery.
Lithium battery, or is there some other kinds of battery?
Now you're asking me to start lying. I don't know. I can find out for you though, if you'd like.
Yeah, and
let you know.
That's what I always hear about, and I'm just
that's what I hear about
wondering
too.
If there's so. Other emerging battery technology.
Yeah, that's what I always hear about, but I can check on it and let you know.
Okay.
So as of May, compared to last year, wind has decreased a little bit in our queue by 3 gigs. Solar has increased by 6 gigs, and storage has doubled. And the other, that 220 megawatts, is fossil resources. I don't know if it's gas. I assume it is. And compared to last year, that's decreased by 300 megawatts. So you see what's happening to the queue. All right. I'm going to hit these real quick. Our integrated market, we operate basically 3 kinds of market. Y'all are familiar with it. We have a market for transmission service where people buy and sell use of the transmission lines that are owned by different members. You've got our integrated marketplace, which is what most people think about when they think about markets, and we operate both a day-ahead and a real-time balancing market. Our integrated marketplace in April celebrated 5 years of existence and generated nearly $3 billion and benefits over that 5-year period, with annual savings on average around $870 million. It's facilitated the growth. This goes to the to something we were talking about, Commissioner Fedorchuk, as it's facilitated the growth in the renewable energy production because they have a way of selling that power. Mm-hmm. And we're also continually trying to improve our market services through our membership, our stakeholder process. Our market working group is the working group that's in charge of coming up with new market services to try to better manage the market. Okay. So talking about renewables, that's kind of what we are now. I know MISO sees a lot of this too. This is the old NREL map. Y'all are familiar with that. Best wind in the country is right in the middle of SPP. Go ahead to the next one. This is kind of the story of wind right now in SPP system. Right now we got about 22 gigs of wind installed in service. our largest wind resource is in Texas. We've got another large wind resource, Sagamore, which if it comes online, will be located in New Mexico, and it will be the largest wind farm in New Mexico. But I said if, because everybody's racing to beat the clock for the PTCs. In 2018, wind consisted of 24% of all generation in the region. Like we said earlier, coal's decreased from 46 to 42%. And this 21 gigs of wind that we talk about up here, that's up from 17 gigs that we had in 2017. So,
is SPP studying the penetration of wind and at what point it gets to be, you know, create difficulties for reliability, or how are you managing that?
So our operators do a really good job of managing all that. A lot of that has to do with how accurate is your forecast, and they're never going to be 100% accurate, but we've gotten to where we do multiple forecasts in order to try to anticipate when those fronts are coming through and what's going to happen to the wind resources. Even at these high levels, the operators have done a good job. I can't tell you what kind of tools they use to do that, because I'm not smart enough to understand all that. Our operators were not crazy to see all this wind come on, but they also knew that we couldn't do anything about it. It is kind of what it is, and they've done a good job.
So what's your highest penetration?
So if you go to the next, you're a good straight man. We set a new record in April of this year, 66.5% of wind penetration at 2 a.m. in the morning. So think about that. There are problems associated with that, right? You're meeting us. Earlier, 3 minutes earlier, we had 70% of renewable penetration, and the difference is probably hydro is what I would guess that added to that.
The difference is probably what?
Hydro.
And what are the technical challenges that are different in the middle of the night when the demand is low versus like in the middle of the day when you've got a huge demand?
Can you
sustain that 70% penetration at that?
No, not without storage.
So is that, see, that seems deceiving to me to throw those figures out that we can handle 70%.
Well, that's what we've done.
I know, but it doesn't usually get, like, no one adds the, but that was at a point of low demand.
Yeah.
I think general consumers look at that and think, well, we could, that's how people believe that you can go 100% renewable. And it isn't technically feasible. So there's this whole bunch of mixed messaging that's going out to the public by the people who know.
Yeah.
People like you guys and utilities telling people that this is possible. And so it's no wonder that they're saying, yeah, we want renewables. And I agree. They're great. But we have to be realistic.
Now, we would never say that we can go 100% renewables.
Have seen this stuff a lot from SPP, a lot. And it's very deceptive because I don't see another follow-up slide any place saying reality is.
And I expect those numbers will increase even a little bit larger.
And that is great, but, you know, what is it in peak demand? What is it on the hottest day of the year? What kind of penetration can you sustain?
And I've seen some slides that talk about the difference in a day, and I didn't include those here. But it reflects exactly what the point is you're making. You know, wind goes from here to here in an hour.
Right.
You know.
Or on January 30th, I'm sure, or 31st, whatever the day was, where I know it was a big deal in MISO. There was a whole bunch of wind expected that didn't show up.
Right.
And there was a lot of work being done to make sure that all the resources that were supposed to be available
were
available, and some of them weren't either.
Right.
So that's the, you know, I'm interested in the realism.
Okay.
Not like the rosiest picture. Like, what's the scariest picture?
Yeah, I hear you.
We need to hear that.
Okay.
Because we have to have this information, too, to make good decisions and to help work with the utilities who are making good decisions. And the public expects that we're looking at the realistic side of things, not the rosiest side of things.
Let me see if I can't get Victor some information to get to y'all.
That would be awesome.
Okay. And I'll try to get that out. It won't be next week because I'm going on vacation, but it'll be soon thereafter.
I am too.
Okay.
So the week after would be great.
All right. So
I think the other part that goes along with that, I've often felt frustration with when we see these kinds of things that Julie's right. It does cause people who are only casually observing to think, yeah, see, why can't we be at 70% every day?
Yeah.
You know? So I think the other thing that needs to be emphasized is all those generation sources that we wanted to be available in late January, when we were hitting 70% wind, they weren't getting anything for their time and investment.
Right.
And so in late January, we paid more for that power than what we'd have had to if this wasn't the case in April, because this was the case in April.
Yeah.
And she's right. People see this, and this is what they walk away with.
Sure. I hear you. So solar, like I said, is the next big thing. We've got a lot of potential for adding additional solar into our region. I've been told by people that supposedly know that we've got some of the best solar potential in the country. I always thought it would have been down in that southwest part of the U.S., but that's not the case because it gets too hot.
When you say where? Geographically speaking?
SPP. So that's it's mainly basically Oklahoma, Texas, and New Mexico. But those dark red areas, what I'm told is it gets too hot there. Solar doesn't operate as well.
We're not exactly in the sweet spot here in North Dakota.
That's what I'm hearing. So,
although they're building here,
are they?
What is it, the panels give people trouble when it's too hot, or what is the temperature?
Yeah, that's my understanding. So a solar in our system, we've talked a little bit about this. Right now we've got 215 megawatts solar in service. That's utility-grade solar. My understanding as of breakfast this morning is that we're going to probably add another 300 this year sometime. You saw the other number. We've got 26 gigs currently being studied for development.
Is that similar to wind, where maybe half will be built, or do you think that will have a higher?
I think it'll be higher than that because they still got the PTC on the solar side.
So you might have 15, 18, 19 gigawatts of solar, 25-ish.
And Chairman, I also don't know how much speculation goes on the solar side. I assume there's a lot.
If you're at 25, did you say 25 to 30% capacity right now?
Mm-hmm.
So essentially, it's going to continue to displace existing resources.
Probably will.
Causing early retirements.
Probably will. Just depending. It depends on, can you deliver those resources to the load or not?
See, that's the biggest challenge in all of this. The whole rate-making process and just the energy market is so convoluted for a number of reasons. One, each state does it a little bit differently.
Yep.
Utilities are incented to spend capital because they get a return on equity.
Mm-hmm.
So as much as we give the green light to, within reason, I think they also have to look at, they can't just double rates overnight, but they're incented.
Sure.
To spend capital. And we look at things in a singular, one-dimensional way quite often. Okay, here's a wind facility. What does it cost to produce energy on a per kilowatt-hour basis?
Yep.
Or megawatt, whatever. Without looking at underlying costs, which is why I asked the original question of how you look at transmission, because then you have transmission in the background, potential additional needs.
Mm-hmm.
Then you're talking about storage. Well, we've got gas peaking plants over here, and I can guarantee it's a slippery slope for the three of us because we don't want consumers to wake up ratepayers one day going, holy cow, you know, our rates
right.
have gone up over the past decade exponentially, which is why I'm really glad we have Victor. And seriously, really glad we have Victor. He crunches that, but it's complicated.
Sure, it is.
Dig through it all.
I agree. So one of the things that we've done, that the board directed us to do, is I've mentioned this holistic integrated tariff team, known as the HIT team. About 10 years ago, the board said that they looked at our planning processes and they looked at our cost allocation processes, and they said, you know, we need to reconsider how we plan and how we do cost allocation. So they came up with, they put together a group that came up with a number of recommendations on both planning and cost allocation. And all of that led to our integrated transmission planning process and our highway-byway cost allocation process. That's 10 years ago. It's worked great. But we now have lots of things that are changing all around us. We've got a market that's in place now, an integrated marketplace, and we weren't thinking in those terms back when we came up with the ITP and with the highway-byway. And as we've talked about here this morning, The generation mix is it's crazy. It's just changing. And trying to get a handle on that and dealing with the new technologies, that was one of the drivers that the board saw. They also wanted to look at ways to enhance our market, to continue to deliver low-cost energy to consumers. And they wanted to better align transmission cost allocation with the markets. In order to make sure that the entities that are getting value from the market are actually paying something for the value that they're getting, okay? So you can go on. This just reflects that changing generation mix. If you look at this kind of overlay map, this shows it. So look at North Dakota. It says 25.8% of the generation here in North Dakota is coming from wind. And you're seeing that across our footprint. So let's go. This is what's, I referred to this earlier, Julie, that you see what's going on with coal. In 2011, it made up 63% of the energy mix, right? And now it's at 42%. And that's in over the course of 7 years, right? That's a drop of 20%. At the same time, you've seen wind increase by about 17%. And gas has kind of stayed steady. And that's what we're dealing with. I'm sure you'd see the same thing in the MISO region or any of the other regions of the country. Okay. So we also, as I mentioned, are trying to figure out ways to enhance our marketplace. What this busy slide shows you is kind of what's happened to prices, average prices across our region over time. Yellow, orange, and red are bad. That means high prices. From my perspective, it's bad. But as we've done two things, particularly since 2007, we started implementing some market products, but also this corresponds a lot with our build-out of our transmission system. And so what's happened is prices have flattened out as you've got more and more in transmission and service, which is a good story to tell. So you've gone from higher prices to low prices across our region. Now, you're going to have days, like you said, when stuff happens, right? And the resources that were supposed to be there weren't. The resources that you would use as backup are frozen or can't get gas or whatever, and that can result in higher prices for that day or that week. So you'll continue to have that unless we and we continue to improve our forecasting ability, but I think there's probably a lot of room for improvement there, too.
So back to a question I asked a little earlier, mm-hmm. but I think this map illustrates, and you said that a lot of the drop in price is a result of the build.
Mm-hmm.
So as you continue to look at integrating the 50 gigawatts of wind in the queue and the 5 gigawatts of storage and 26 gigawatts of solar, even if only half of that comes on, do you see a day where the case could be made just by eliminating or reducing congestion that it's economic to have another major build-out that people will be paying for in order to bring these new resources online and reduce? It's just because it'll be lower cost energy.
I don't anticipate that, but I don't have anything to back that up with either.
And that's not something that you have any working groups looking at, that type of long-term planning?
Well, I mean, our economic studies working group manages the planning process for us, and that would be the between them and our strategic planning committee, which are made up primarily of board members but also members that are the kind of the strategic thinkers for the company.
Okay.
And they try to, and that's what this whole HIT process was kind of originated from. They're the ones that are trying to come to grips with what's the future going to look like and how are we going to deal with it. Mm. So,
and who's on the HIT team?
Oh, goodness.
Such a great name.
They're different from different segments of the of our.
Do you know the numbers?
Customers.
Yeah, I think there were around about 20 or 25 people on the HIT team, and it was a collection of maybe five or six from investor-owned utilities, a couple people from state cooperatives, and there was also heavy involvement from the cost allocation working group. They also had about, I think, maybe six or seven members.
And we've had two RSC members that have participated in that over the last year. They've met like, I don't know, 17 times in the last year to try to come to grips with these recommendations. The two that are serving from the RSC.
Thank you.
The two from the, I'm sure your time's coming, Randy. But the two that have volunteered and have been there the whole time are Sherry Albrecht from Kansas and Dennis Grinnan from Nebraska. So,
Sam, before you leave this slide, though,
mm-hmm.
What is the low-cost energy that you're using to come up with these figures? Is this the retail price that people are paying?
It's the price per megawatt.
To produce it or to deliver it to the customer?
These are the wholesale prices based on where the energy is actually sold. So.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm glad I had our market monitor here with me. So let's go to the next one. So this is one of the other drivers, is aligning transmission cost planning and cost allocation with what's going on in the market and a consolidated balancing authority. One of the issues that they've been trying to address is, if you look at that map on the left, those are kind of our transmission pricing zones, and those, as entities join SPP, they just bring whatever their pricing, their zone was. And so there's been no attempt really to try to consolidate and change some of that. The HIT has come up with some recommendations to try to get the working groups to start looking at that. So this is an overview, and this is going to be really high level because I have not been following this. There are basically 21 recommendations in their draft report. And that report will go to the board next month at their meeting. The HIT is a function of the board, so the board will be the only ones, as far as I know, taking any kind of action on the recommendations out of the report. But five of those 21 recommendations are reliability-focused, four are marketplace-focused, and then the rest are planning, or cost allocation, or strategic issues. Of those 21, 13 recommendations are things that have to be done in the next, like, 2 years, okay? And then eight are recommendations for additional study or evaluation of whatever the issue might be. Okay. All right. These are the way those recommendations, these are the recommendations under each of those areas. It's been a lot of work. It'll be interesting to see how these issues work their way out through our stakeholder process for the various working groups. That'll be assigned responsibility for dealing with these issues. Let's move on.
Do you place any weight on state REOs, renewable energy objectives?
Well, if the state has an RPS or something like that, our planners include that. But, I mean, if you looked at that map that's an overlay showing how much wind is in each state right now, all the states have blown. I mean, that wind's just blown through whatever those requirements are. So they've met those years ago. So go to the next slide. These are the working groups that I mentioned that are assigned certain the draft recommendations, and some are the primary working group and some are secondary. The Regional State Committee will be looking at cost the C1, C2, C4. Those are cost allocation issues, and those are solely within the responsibility of the states. And that's what Victor and Randy are going to be busy with over the next year, because they've got a goal of trying to get those completed by July of next year. And those are some of the market issues. All right. So this is the timeline. Like I said, you see that there's one recommendation that's going to go to the board already for action at their July meeting. But the rest of these will be addressed at the various board meetings and MOPSI meetings between July and April of 2021. So plenty to do. Okay, and I had heard that there was some interest in talking a little bit about what we're doing in the West. What we've kind of unveiled is we have our Western Energy Services kind of portfolio that we've started developing. And they're all basically a portfolio of contract-based products that we will provide to entities in the West that want to sign a contract and receive these services. As you've probably seen something about it, we will be the reliability coordinator for about 20% of the load in the West. California ISO will serve the other 80%. We also are planning to stand up an imbalance service market for the entities that had that are interested in it, and the ones that we've primarily been talking to up to this point are folks from the Old Mountain West Transmission Group. That was a group of utilities that was wanted to become members of SPP. The contract service customers, though, it's not about joining the RTO. It's about receiving the services to help them integrate some of their resource mix in a more efficient and economic way. We're doing some planning, offering planning coordination for people that are interested in it, and we've been providing what's called unscheduled flow mitigation. It's trying to deal with people that have certain, like, I don't know if it's phase shifters or Finkel phasers, or, and managing those facilities for a number of entities in the West. Let me say one thing.
Well, yeah. When you say it's about providing the services but not membership,
yeah.
But for $6,000, they can
sure.
join and become part of the
they can.
Advisory council.
They can.
They just wouldn't be on, like, the RSC or COG. Or
that's right. I apologize. I don't have a timeline in here. What we're asking for, we've been working pretty fast and fairly aggressively, which is not our nature on either account, to try to get the imbalance service out there and available to folks. We've asked people that if you're interested in receiving that service, that market service from us, we need to have contracts signed by July 26th. That will enable us to then get that market up and running by December 2020. So that's pretty fast to do all that. We we've had plenty of expertise at running a market like that. Did we talk about that in these slides at all? Okay, we'll get there. So for our RC services, these are the entities that have signed contracts with us. We will begin to provide that service to these entities in December of this year, okay? At which time Peak RC, which has been the reliability coordinator in the West for some time, will go out of business, okay? Go ahead, Lee. I've already covered that, and this is the milestones. We'll have WEC and NERC on site, is my understanding, in August. To make sure that they think that we're ready to be the RC provider in the West. This is nothing new to us. We've been providing reliability coordination service to our members in the East since for 22 years. So we do know what we're doing in this area. I have. Yeah, we do talk a little bit about it. So these are some of the benefits of an imbalanced market in the West. Basically, it's a more efficient use of the generation and transmission system that's out there today. Entities will be able to continue with any bilateral trades that they have, and we will respect their existing transmission service rights. The first year benefits before we had an integrated market, we had an imbalanced market. State regulators and the members, when we started talking about markets, they weren't sure. They weren't sure that they trusted the whole idea of a market. So we said, okay, so we kicked off, did a cost-benefit study to see what an imbalanced service market, what kind of benefits they would provide compared to the cost. And that last bullet talks to that. It says that the first-year benefits were $103 million, which was about $20 million more than we anticipated, and that's associated with $33 million in implementation costs to get that imbalanced market stood up. Go ahead. This were the benefits over 7 years. So we only provide an imbalanced market for 7 years, and during that period of time, ratepayers saw $1.2 billion in lower production costs than they would have otherwise had to pay. We think we are certainly qualified to provide an imbalanced market out in the West. We've had a long history of providing contract services to folks in the East. As I said, we operated an imbalanced market for 7 years. And our utilization or our provision of RC services in the West will also minimize some of the working costs because we'll use some of the same data that we'll be utilizing for the RC services. So we think those are all benefits. We'll see what happens on July 26th. So we've been asked what happens if Public Service of Colorado decides not to go in, and so we have calculated cost with and without Public Service of Colorado. And so the people that we've been talking to have seen those numbers, and see what happens. Pretty exciting. Although I stay on the road all the time. That's okay. That's what they pay me for. So,
is there kind of a time certain when Public Service Company makes a decision?
No.
It seems like it has pretty big impact on all the others.
It can, yeah. But, I mean, some of the other entities out there, that they want to go, period, with or without PSCO. So, and WAPA's been one of our big fans out in the West, the Western Area Power Administration, I'm sorry. so we'll see what happens, you know. That's it for me.
You have 7 seconds left.
Pretty good. Well, and we'll get to that information that you were asking for, okay? You want to go ahead?
Sure. As being a pro, getting it to 7 seconds of the allotted hour, that's very good. I hope I can do as good.
I've done it a time or two.
Slightly different presentation here. And so I'm Greg Sorensen. I'm the supervisor of the... I guess we can take a break here. So I'm Greg Sorensen. I'm the supervisor of the market surveillance group for the Southwest Power Pool Market Monitoring Unit. And so I'll be giving a little bit of an overview for how we do business as the SPP Market Monitoring Unit and what our role is overall. Then I'll be giving some highlights from our 2018 Annual State of the Market Report. This is just one of our roles is to monitor the market and provide analysis for a variety of stakeholders, which includes state commissions, the public, as well as potential people who might be interested in getting involved in the marketplace. So they kind of understand the underlying economic situation as well as market participants so they can make better decisions to participate in the market. Then I'll also be going over a few of the highlights from some of the winter events that occurred that we presented in our 2019 Winter Quarterly State of the Market Report. So I'll be talking a little bit about those because I think that addresses some concerns. So. Okay, so the should I wait for Julie or is it should I wait for the other commissioner or I can?
So you want to take a little break?
Sure. Take a quick break or
how long is your presentation?
It's probably about 45 minutes or so, so we can take it.
And then did you have something to add to it, Julie? Or?
He's just here to look pretty.
Not doing a good job of that.
Yeah, maybe we should just wait a couple minutes if you're pretty confident.
Yeah.
I don't know where she disappeared to.
So you guys are taking off this afternoon then?
I am. Leah's. He's got a grandma somewhere east of here.
My grandma lives in Grand Forks, so I'm going to go visit her over the weekend.
Good for you. Are you guys on like that 1 o'clock flight or?
It is.
Neither one of them's listening.
I think there's the five. So.
5:30.
Okay, so you're not pressed to want to leave earlier. We decided to take just a little break.
Oh, that's good. Thanks.
McKenna, how did you end up not working tomorrow? Well, this was a pretty short stay. This was a pretty short stay. What are you going to do the rest of the summer?
It is. That one.
Okay.
This is what I'm really interested in.
Okay, so I'm Greg Sorensen, the supervisor of the market surveillance group at the market monitoring unit. So basically be talking about the organization, the market monitoring unit, then we'll have some discussion about some 2018 annual state of the market results. And then finally, we'll be talking about some of the winter weather events that occurred in the winter of 2019, just to give an overview of how the market performed during that time. So likewise, please feel free to ask questions about anything that's on the slides or other things, because this is an educational session. So happy to take questions throughout, and then we'll have a few minutes at the end as well. We have three missions that are laid out in the SVP tariff. Attachment AF and AG govern the market monitoring unit. And basically we have three main functions. One is to report and monitor on possible abuses of horizontal and vertical market power. So we do analysis every day to see who has market power in different regions of SPP and to make sure that they're not exercising that to an undue degree. Also, we identify market design flaws and recommend any changes to improve the operation of the markets. And so some of those design flaws may be because the underlying mix of resources has changed, there's some issues that have arisen over the past several years. Other market design flaws may be things that could improve the efficiency of the market. And then occasionally we do find things that are, this is an exploitation opportunity that we would like to get closed before it turns into a problem. So those are kind of the design flaws that we specifically look for. The third thing we do is we monitor compliance of market participants with the market rules in the tariff. So for instance, there's some rules on after the market clears, all the resources are supposed to follow the dispatch instructions based on their clearing process. We monitor and make sure that people are generally following those over time. There's some specific rules about mitigated offers, which is a mitigation of undue market power to make sure people are accurately calculating cost-based offers. So we monitor those on a next-day basis. And then we also have other things in the tariff we're supposed to specifically look for, and we may conduct outreach with market participants, ask them questions, ask them to demonstrate why they're behaving in a certain way that seems unusual. So we are independent of the rest of the SPP RTO. We're also independent of the members and market participants, and we're independent of FERC as well. So we do coordinate, and we do brief FERC on what types of activities we're seeing in the market. So FERC has a market analysis group, so we talk to them about overall trends we see in the market. And then if there's any open referrals or investigations, we do coordinate with them and answer the questions they may have on things that occur. We report to the Oversight Committee of the Board of Directors. So Keith Collins, who's the Executive Director of the MMU, he reports directly to the Oversight Committee. He does not report to the officers of SPP. So if there's in addition to monitoring the market participants, we also monitor RTO operations related to markets. We don't have any oversight of any sort of liability activity, but they have certain requirements that they're supposed to post. The regulation requirements for the next day, and so we make sure that they're procuring, make sure they're basically following procedures that are laid out for them in the tariff to properly operate the market. So we monitor that as well. So independence is necessary because that allows us to be advisors to various stakeholders in the process, but we're non-decisional in that process. So we do not vote in the stakeholder process, but we certainly provide input, particularly around data. If there's market data questions, these are how we're viewing the market, and provide that to the market participants. We also investigate potential problems as they may occur. So, and we do that. So we do have a complaint process that people can, including state commissions, can raise if they have a concern with the market monitor, or if they have a particular question that they feel like a market monitor data would be useful for. That's something that we can do and provide. And we have done that with a number of the state commissions over time. Our role is to protect the market. So unlike a lot of the other groups, we're also charged with looking at it from the consumer's perspective. So not just the wholesale market, is it working well for the generators and others, but also is it working well for the consumers? So we have a specific viewpoint that we're required to take when we look at how is the overall market functioning. And our focus is ensuring workable competition. So electric utility business, there's you know, it's not really a perfect competition. There are certain circumstances where only certain people can serve certain loads at certain times. That occurs, but we're just trying to ensure that there's workable competition in the markets and that the markets are providing an accurate result. I think there's some questions as we go through here of, hey, are these generators earning enough money to cover their costs in the market so they're available on the January day and they're not being unduly harmed on the April day? So as we've gone through here, we've identified some additional reliability products that may be required. And those are opportunities for generators that are providing those reliability services to be appropriately compensated for that. Because they're going to get compensated one way or the other way, and it's either they're going to come to a state commission in a rate-making process and say, hey, we're providing this service for free to everybody, and we need to be paid for it. Or an even better way to do that is to have, well, what product is being provided, and then maybe the market as a whole, who's benefiting from that, should be paying a lot of that cost. So those are some of the recommendations that you'll see as we talk about the 2018 annual state of the market report. That's you know, one way forward. So we have a highly trained staff with diverse backgrounds. We have 16 staff and three main teams. So one team does market analysis, which digs deep into market outcomes and looks at more holistic, longer term problems. So we'll have, do we have the right amount of spinning reserve? Do we have the right amount of these different products over time? Another group deals with market policy. So particularly when we review revision requests, we want to look and make sure that, does it appear to us that they're solving the problems? We also look at them to make sure they're not introducing a unforeseen problem. And we're also trying to look at, is the rule clear? Because I think one problem that we've observed over time is that sometimes the rules aren't clear, which is actually not beneficial to anyone in the process because it's ambiguous to both the market participant as well as to regulators. We have a variety of backgrounds. So we have some economics, some engineers, accountants, computer science. So we have a couple of PhD economists on our staff, a few people with MBAs, a professional engineer. Have a couple people with NERC RC certifications, so that allows us to look at the problems from a variety of standpoints and help to understand what types of issues we may have. Because a lot of times when you're dealing with anomalous behavior, it's important to understand not just the perspective of here's the market rule, but also, you know, what types of issues actually happen at power plants, what types of issues actually happen in operations rooms, so that people can be appropriately deciding what to do. So one group, the group that I'm a supervisor of, we conduct market surveillance. So we look at market offers and make sure that the mitigated offers are following the market requirements. We also look at physical parameters and review those and see if any of those need to be mitigated because they may be leading to unusual market outcomes. We also review the market outcomes in general to understand, you know, if we have high prices, is that driven by underlying conditions in the market or not? So obviously on high load days, generally people expect the prices to be higher. So is that what's being actually borne out by the market results or not? You know, so we should see the peak price at the peak hour. Do we see that or not? So we kind of answer those questions. Try to understand if transmission congestion, what is being driven by, if it's being driven by too much generation or it's being driven by the load is higher on a particular day. So we you know, dig into that, and if we see unusual transmission outages, we will contact the company and validate that transmission maintenance actually needed to occur and is appropriate for the time that they took the outage for. We screen offers and transactions. We'll also review operator manual actions. So sometimes SEP has to commit resources to either deal with a local reliability issue or a transmission congestion issue, and trying to make sure that they're following the rules and being non-discriminatory as they're required to be by the tariff. So that's a market monitor role to review that. And then we also try to look at overall risk to the market and understand how the changing resource mix is affecting things. And then are we looking at the right risks in the market overall? Because as we've seen maybe from 2014 to now, we've seen that there's the total amount of money going to generators to deal with serving the load has gone down. Part of that is due to lower prices in natural gas. But also we've seen the transmission congestion right market continue to increase as the overall amount of money involved. And so we've, you know, reassigned some of our resources to spend more time looking at that particular market so that we're allocating our resources to where the money is actually being traded. We also monitor for manipulation. That's something we're required to do by the tariff. And again, our goal is to help maintain an open and competitive market. So we have a variety of screening processes that we look for on a variety of time frames. We have follow-up and discuss with market participants in question. So, for example, a power plant may have a lower maximum on a particular day than what they normally do. That could be due to a variety of problems that might occur at the plant. So we'll ask that participant for additional documentation to substantiate why that unusual activity was observed. Most of those cases were able to resolve simply through discussions with the market participants. Occasionally, we do have to refer things to FERC, and I'd say probably on average, we'll refer 1 to 2 violations a year to FERC that are of an egregious, long-term, ongoing nature that they need to be dealt with by the commission. And so the commission has methods they can use to investigate and, you know, do that type of thing. So, you know, that's a very, very small percentage of the things we look into. Most of the market participants we deal with, you know, have a good culture of compliance, so they will address the problem, correct the problem, and make sure the problem doesn't happen again. So, and we do, if people say, hey, we fixed this so it doesn't happen again, we do monitor that to make sure that the problem's actually been resolved. We also look at market efficiency, looking at overall market performance, participate in the stakeholder process with comments on revision requests, and we do occasionally propose new design changes to try to address issues. We do have the ability, and occasionally we will oppose certain and support certain design changes in the stakeholder processes and at FERC. We do typically file comments on a number of revision requests, either in support or against, and like anything else that goes to FERC, you know, sometimes they will take our comments on board. Sometimes they will say, thank you very much. That's not what we're interested in here. But we do make those comments and are involved in that process. But a lot of times, if we do have concerns early in the process, the stakeholders will take those on board and they will make adjustments to address those. And then we can, you know, give our full support. Just like any other stakeholder in the process, you know, one of the benefits of SPP is, you know, maybe there's an issue that a certain utility has or a certain group of utilities has, they can bring that forward, and a lot of times people will incorporate those. Looking at market transparency, so markets also rely on transparency to effectively function. So are the appropriate things being posted to the public market participants so they can take action? So, you know, are the outages being appropriately posted? Is SPP meeting all its posting requirements that are laid out in the tariff? And that helps the market participants make intelligent decisions to try to help the market function properly. We also publish annual, quarterly, and monthly reports. We are responsible for developing the what I call frequently constrained air reports. That doesn't really affect anything in North Dakota. Those are in the southwest Missouri and western Kansas. And we do also occasionally do other ad hoc reports or white papers. So energy storage is probably one we worked on recently, but we've done several others over the course of the year to look at what types of issues are out there. So SPP has a lot of computer-based training that they offer, and this is something that's open to state commission staff. So we can give permission. The SPP training group does a good job of putting these together. So we have a few that are related to market monitoring. So we deal with market power, market manipulation, market mitigation overview, and talks about automatic mitigations and must offer requirements. And there's another 400 titles that relate to SPP operations. So if you have new commission staff members, this is good training. And it's something SPP provides for free to state commissions and state commission staff. We just have to have logins of, Victor, you have any staff that are...
Well, is it online or is it in person?
It's online, so yeah. Okay. These are all online trainings. SCP does also do operator conferences, and they do have like an integrated marketplace symposium that do once a year that's in person. But, you know, all of this is a computer-based training that's online and available for your staff.
One of the things we did, I guess it was in January after the board meeting, was we had our trainers there at New Orleans where the board met. And we had a day and a half of integrated marketplace training for the commissioners that could make it, as well as the state staff. And it was the first time I had sat through the training, and I thought it was pretty well done. It was good enough that then we took it down to the Texas Commission, and they had about 40 staff that they wanted to participate in it.
Jeez.
And then,
40?
And those, Julie, those are all the new ones. Okay. And then, actually, that's not true, because they also cover MISO and ERCOT and SPP, so. And they got El Paso, which is out in the Western Interconnection, and they just didn't know SPP markets. So, but yeah, and then we've got the Arkansas Commission staff that will be participating in an in-person training in Little Rock, end of September, first part of October of this year. So we're trying to get. I mean, it doesn't do any good for me to go out and talk about markets, because I don't know what I'm talking about. But these trainers are really good at understanding and getting across to folks how the market works. So
yeah, I did the in-person training in Louisiana. It was fantastic.
They make it fun.
They do.
Go figure.
Yeah. You in 40 Texas.
No. That was in Austin.
Okay.
Yeah. My takeaway from that one is apparently I need a raise if they have.
Exactly.
Was that?
It's apparently I need a raise. 40 of them doing the same job as me.
Yeah. Well, you can tell your wife you do the work of 40.
That's right.
Sorry for that interruption. I just wanted to go
away. Oh, that's okay. Yeah, that's good. So some advisory role projects that we're involved in the market monitoring unit. So we are assisting the OMS RSC project on the MISO SPP seams. You know, we're involved in that. That's still pretty early in the process, so they're still working on, I think, some rate pancaking and some issues with, you know, dispatch and those kinds of activities. So it's pretty early in the process. I don't have a lot to really report on, but a couple people in the MOU are involved in that.
Aren't you working with the MISO Market Monitor?
We are working with the MISO Market Monitor, Potomac Economics, on that project as well.
And you're putting together a report or some sort of a study?
Yeah, working on reports and studies. I think probably there's going to be probably three reports, because the RSC and OMS determined that there's kind of like tier one projects, tier two projects, and tier three projects. And so I think the vision is that at the end of tier one, we'll have one report, and then tier two might come 6 months later, and tier three might be 6 months after that. That way people can start making decisions on what they want to do with the information a little bit sooner.
Yeah. That's good.
That's the view for that. And then Western Energy Services Market. So as the MMU, we would be the market monitor for that Western Energy Services Market as well. So a number of the market rules are going to be the same. So that's going to, you know, allow basically similar types of oversight. So we would probably add a staff member for that. But a lot of our existing screens we can just incorporate. And then also we're involved in various revision requests to the integrated market through the market working group. So I think the RAMP product, which allows people to be compensated for providing RAMP up and RAMP down reliability services, that's going through the stakeholder process and should be at the board hopefully in July. And then other types of other revision requests, we are involved in those as well. So I have the contact information slide listed here. So Keith Collins is our executive director. Jody Woods is the manager for policy and reporting, and she was the manager for the day-ahead market process until about a year ago. And then John Lou Allen is the supervisor of our analysis group. So, and we do have a 24/7 on-call number and an on-call email as well for various issues. So now I'll move into the state of the market, some of the highlights from that. So overall, the SPP markets are competitive and efficient. So my discussion here will be about wholesale energy prices. Those are overall low, have a low frequency of mitigation, which means overall there's not really too many concerns about market power. Have low levels of make-whole payments, which is a good sign because that means that people are earning enough revenue in the market to cover their generator costs for the most part. Not always. That's why there's make-whole payments, so people are encouraged to offer their resource into the market status, and they're at least guaranteed to make their offer back over that period of time if they're chosen to run. They may not make a margin above that, but that make-whole payment helps encourage people to fully participate in the market, which is good for consumers. We also found there's low levels of unoffered economic capacity. And so that means that basically if people can make money, they're generally offered on those days. So, and that kind of deals with like outage scheduling. So, you know, are people scheduling the outages and the times it makes sense to schedule those outages? And, you know, and yeah, for the most part, they are. So, so some market drivers. So some SPP market characteristics, and these may be different than other markets. So load generally secures 99 to 101% of its requirements in the day-ahead market. So you might say, well, why 101? Well, there's always some forecast errors that may occur. So we generally find that people are trying to buy what they can in the day-ahead market, what they need in the day-ahead market. And so that helps to ensure that generators are fully participating because that means they have a customer available in the day-ahead market. So in the Dakotas and Iowa reserve zone, so SPP has five different reserve zones, and one is the Dakotas and the portion of Iowa that's in the integrated system. There's some moderate market concentration in the winter. There's not really market concentration in the summer to speak of. So that's just something we kind of keep an eye on as the market monitor to make sure that nobody's trying to overly inflate the price. Demand increases should lead to price increases. That's something that we look at, and we do generally see that, particularly in the day-ahead market. We see that a lot where the load profile and the day-ahead market prices match. And then reliability challenges should lead to price increases, which should eventually incent behavior to get the problem solved. So that's one thing we try to see is the question of if there's a reliability problem, does the price get high, and then does the price getting high cause somebody else to enter the market either on a short-term or long-term basis?
Mm-hmm.
So we do see that. There are a couple days where sometimes at the beginning of the winter time, if it gets cold a little bit sooner, it could be a little bit tighter generation conditions, so prices go up, and then you see over the next couple days, people are working hard to get outages wrapped up and get systems back in service. So we usually will see a market signal before there's like a bona fide reliability problem. So.
Greg, would you elaborate more on the market concentration problem, and what do you do about it?
Yeah, so I don't know that I would say it's a problem. So there's some guidelines that look at, you know, can any one market participant set the price in any 5-minute interval, and that's based on what generation's online and available to the market is what we look at. So it could be that there's other market participants that, for whatever reason, we're on an outage that day or didn't participate in the market that day, and so it can cause other, you know, they're not available to step into the market. So, you know, is it a problem? You know, I think there's a lot of markets that have some moderate concentration, even in not just in electricity markets. So none of them are in what we call the high concentration area. So high concentration is when there's starts to be a lot of concerns about people overly using market power. Moderate concentration means they can sometimes set the price, and sometimes that's okay. So I think in the Iowa and Dakotas areas, that market concentration actually exists in the lower demand hours in the North and South Dakota areas. So that means that for the base load units, there's one market participant that owns a disproportionate amount of those. But for the peaking units, it's actually more distributed. So there's a high demand hours, there's actually several people that can serve that load at the prevailing natural gas prices, not just one participant. So, and I think that's something that can inform, you know, when people come with generator decisions and say, hey, I want to build a new base load unit or new peaking unit, you know, those market concentration things can kind of come up. You know, is it the same person that already has the market power? Maybe that's not as good. If it's a new person coming, that might be good. And so it helps to inform investment decisions. So we would not say that moderate market concentration is not necessarily bad. We do have another reserve zone in Texas and New Mexico that has high market concentration all throughout the summer. Mm-hmm. So that's something we keep a much closer eye on. So. So here you can see the S&P prices over time. So you see in the purple, you have the Panhandle Eastern Pipeline gas cost. That's one of the drivers of the marginal price. You see the real-time price in green, and then the day-ahead price in the light blue. So as you can see, you know, low natural gas prices is one of the drivers of low prices in SPP as well. So I think we talked a lot about renewables putting downward pressure on prices, but also natural gas puts a lot of downward pressure on prices. So our load was about 6% higher in 2018 compared to 2017. So a lot of that, I think, was due to the weather, a little bit colder in 2018 than what it was in 2017 in the winter months. And then it was not as about the same in July, but August was a hotter month than it was the previous August. So that caused some of the load to go up. So I'd say about 2% of the load increase was due to improvement in economics, and about 4% was due to the weather. So that might go down next year. So
it'll be warmer.
What's that?
You're predicting a warmer winter? Is that what you're telling me?
I'm saying it's possible that it's a warmer winter. I don't think that panned out in 2019. So
I'd really like it if you'd say it's going to be a warmer winter.
Yeah, I don't know. I can. I don't know if I'm... you know, the weatherman might say that too, and he may not be right. So take that with a grain of salt.
But, right.
Greg, so you said about 2% is market growth.
Yeah.
Are we getting to a point where consumers, and mm-hmm. I can't remember the term you used for Walmart and Google, the two new members,
yeah,
but large companies like that, that come in, are they making up a significant part of the market growth? But then the second part of the question is, how helpful is it when they become bossy and determine how they're going to be served?
Right.
So at that point, is market growth helpful or a hindrance?
Yeah, I think, I think some growth in general is good. I think what's good is we see the load that's growing is more distributed over time. So it's not peaking load. It's more of a longer term load, which I think is better because it gives the base load generation more opportunities to sell and also helps avoid the need to pay for more expensive peaking generation that might only be used for a few hours. So I think that's good. I think one of the challenges, though, is that they're sometimes a little bit, you know, they don't always, you know, they don't always provide the right, maybe the second part of your question deals with, are they providing the right incentives or not? I think that's a little bit of an open question.
If they're setting up in the town of their choosing,
yeah,
and then choosing what kind of energy they want, mm-hmm. I mean, to me, that would suggest that at least sometimes there has to be generation issues involved with that too. Mm-hmm. And so does it all come together to be detrimental to what we're trying to do as far as find the most efficient and reliable energy grid?
Yeah, I think that's a little bit of a – I'm not sure that's a question I have a real – I can't give you a certain opinion on right off the top of my head. So,
okay.
Give me thoughts. I think a lot of the areas in SPP, there's not really real tech competition, so they put down in one area, and that's kind of who the provider is generally going to be. But that's not the case all the time, though, certainly. So we do see our congestion patterns are shifting a little bit. So we do see some particularly southern part of our footprint tends to have a lot of congestion, some higher prices. Would point out that in western North Dakota, there's what appears to be some higher prices, and that's actually more due to a lot of the load out there is drilling load in the Bakken shale area. So that area generally sees the same price, whether it's daytime or nighttime, so it doesn't have the same sort of load changes over the course of the day. So they're still drilling regardless of whether it's night or not night, whereas a lot of other load in our footprint, you know, they have high prices during the day where there's a lot of heating and cooling load, and then low prices at night. So you'll see that it looks like there's some congestion here, but that's really 24-hour prices. So a lot of that is due to overnight prices not getting lower. But even so, it's still around that somewhere between $20 and $30 on the wholesale market. So it's not excessively high, but it's just a little bit higher than some other areas. And again, I think Sam already kind of talked on this. So I'll go through this part kind of quick. But, you know, a lot of wind and solar being added. Did see some natural gas peaking plants to provide some more flexibility to the market added in 2017. But we did see a number of gas plants and coal plants being retired in 2018. And most of those coal plants were in Missouri and Kansas as part of the Westar Kansas City Power and Light merger. Capacity, still have a lot of capacity at the peak during the peak hours. So, you know, peak load is around 50,000 megawatts in the summertime. And on those peak days, there were about 67,000 megawatts of available generation to serve those loads, which means the prices are not going to get that high. And so people are not going to have the opportunity to earn their big peaking dollars during those particular intervals. So the prices don't necessarily get that high on those peaking days, which can be a concern. If I was going to build a peaking generator, I'm not going to really make my return on investment, so I'm disincentivized from providing that. And our analysis in the MMU has shown that, you know, generally you're not going to earn a return on investment for any new generation that's not subsidized until some generation retires. And that's just due to the, you know, 33% peak available capacity. There's a lot of extra capacity out there in the marketplace. Wind capacity and generation keeps going up. So capacity is around 20,000 megawatts. Generation is about 67,000 gigawatt hours. So,
Greg, back on that previous slide, what's included in that peak available capacity?
So peak available capacity, we included thermal generation, and then based on the nameplate, but also derated for the, basically just, we did an analysis of what outages were in place over the summertime. So about 4% of thermal generation's not available for any particular summer day, just due to, you know, outages, forced outages, et cetera. And then we also looked at wind. We looked at the historical basis during the peak hours in the summertime. So that wind has about 21% of its nameplate was included. And that was based on analysis of its actual performance during that time period. Same thing with solar. We looked at its actual performance. Now, its actual performance in the summertime is about 75% on the peak hour. So it's actually quite a bit better in terms of serving the peak. I think that's a benefit of solar power, is it lines up better with the peak hour than what wind does. And so it's not every single nameplate, but the peak available capacity is based on what's actually available.
Accredited capacity.
It's similar to accredited capacity, but ours is more historical as opposed to...
One thought I just started having when you started explaining some of that. So, you know, we have, 20 gigs of wind.
Yeah.
If none of that's available, we actually would have a significant problem.
Yeah, if none of that was available, the conditions would be very tight, yes. And we do have some days where there's only 3 or 4% of the load is being served by the wind, and on those days we do see much higher prices than what we do on the higher wind days.
Just a thought.
And what was the percentage of solar available for the peak capacity?
So about 75% of the nameplate is available. So one thing that we see is good is that the self-committed startup instructions continue to decrease from 2016 to 2017 to 2018. So we feel like that means that market participants are getting more confidence in the market software to make appropriate decisions on commitments. So that's a good sign. So you know, we see the day-ahead markets making more and more of the starting decisions, which, since it optimizes over a whole day, that does tend to be a more optimal solution. So we feel like that's a good activity. So in any market, you know, market confidence, the market participants, and the overall market functioning properly is important. And we do continue to have some manual commitments, and we also have a reliability unit commitments processes that those look at more current forecasts for the wind and may make unit commitments because the wind forecast that's being used for the day ahead market is the one that was in effect at, you know, 8 a.m. or 9 a.m. the day before. And so obviously, you know, the weather can change between yesterday and today. So that occurs. Some market drivers, low gas prices, the large reserve margin, high levels of wind generation, and except for weather variations, generally the load grows pretty flat. So those are things that drive the market and generally drive low prices in the market. And so we talked about wind and coal trending in the opposite directions. So, you know, coal's going down, wind's going up. Also in 2019, we're seeing even lower natural gas prices than in 2018. So particularly in West Texas, we've actually seen some negative gas prices. And I think in Wyoming, we've seen some gas prices around $1 per MMBTU. I think maybe North Dakota, they're still around $2 to $2.50. But that continues to permeate throughout the country. So I would expect to see, you know, the gas generation in 2019 to go up, and, you know, coal would probably go down just because its fuel cost is actually more expensive for the most part than natural gas. So that being said, different coal plants have different types of fuel they use and different costs. So that may or may not be representative of any particular coal plant, but these are the overall numbers.
So in your role of evaluating this and planning for the future, do you contemplate the possibility of in 2 years or 4 years or 6 years? What if there's some kind of significant regulations and fracking is not happening anymore and we're not producing all this gas? Or maybe something that we're not even thinking of regulatory-wise that changes gas prices significantly, because Victor and I look back at gas prices one time kind of on a mid-decade to mid-decade point going back into the 70s. And every time we think we've reached a new stability a decade later, it's either way higher or way cheaper. Or do we just assume that wherever gas prices are is where they're going to pretty much always be?
I think they certainly can move around a lot from 1 year to the next year and one decade to the next decade, because a lot of the and I think there's also an interplay between oil prices and natural gas prices, because a lot of the natural gas is a byproduct of the oil drilling process. So if oil prices were to drop, I think the natural gas prices might actually, you know, they might go up because there's not as much of an excess supply. So
what assumptions do you use?
I think it's, you know, I think there's a value in when we do these studies looking at, okay, what does $2 gas look like? What does, you know, $4 gas look like? What does, you know, $8 gas look like? Because we've seen all those prices at various times. And so, you know, I think understanding, well, what's the risk in different types of fuel? You know, one of the, I think coal prices are a lot less volatile. So, you know, they do kind of act as a hedge against the natural gas prices going up. And I think there's a market risk question that's borne by the market participants is, you know, well, how much do I value that risk? And, you know, do I think, and that's kind of a market participant question. But I think in economic studies, there's a lot of value in looking at various types of fuel costs and understanding, you know, what's the dispatch going to look like under various conditions.
I think it's more long-term in nature.
Yeah.
Because when you look at, right now, crude oil is the number one fuel source globally, and that's going to continue till approximately 2034 is what the modeling shows. But crude oil also along the way will increase by 1.5% over the next, in terms of annual usage over the next several decades. So the associated gas that you're talking about from shale plays in particular will continue to be coming online. And there just isn't an economic model out there that suggests we're going to see, outside of the occasional spike for a polar vortex or winter in North Dakota type event. So it's, I just don't see the modeling changing a whole lot, at least for the next decade at a minimum. Yeah. It's just going to be there. And I think fracking in terms of the environmental concerns, because that's a bridge fuel to get away from dirtier fossil fuels, if you will, I think won't come under a lot of pressure yet, but eventually it will.
Right. Yeah.
I think it all depends on who's elected president. It could come under a whole lot of pressure in short order, depending on where things go in 2020.
Yeah.
I don't see it.
No, I think those
I hope
are
you're
all,
right.
Those are all very, very excellent points, Commissioner. So, yeah, those that is a very open question. You know, what will the future hold for gas prices? There's a lot of outside things that can affect it. I would agree. So we talk about make-whole payments. That deals with like market efficiency. So haven't seen a whole lot of change from 2016 to 2018. So those tend to be higher in the wintertime because they're fuel prices tend to be higher in the wintertime than in the summertime.
Can you talk a little bit more about this concept, the make-whole
sure.
payments?
Yeah,
so explain what it is.
Yeah,
I'm not familiar with
the concept behind a make-whole payment is to encourage the generators to offer into the market. Basically, each generator has a startup cost, and it might say, okay, it cost me, you know, $5,000 to start this combustion turbine, and then for each hour it's online, I need to clear at least, you know, $1,500 to cover my online cost, and then, you know, the energy might be priced at $30 a megawatt hour, just as an example. And so basically the make-whole payment is the clearing engine will say we need a certain amount of resources online to meet the load any given hour, and so that might mean I need to start a unit that has to run for 8 hours, and so at the end of that 8 hour time, hopefully the LMPs are high enough to cover all those generators' costs. But if they're not, then the difference between that startup offer, no load offer, and the energy at minimum versus the LMP that they're paid at minimum, if that's not met, then that unit gets a make-whole payment to cover their costs. So kind of the guarantee in the market is if you offer and the market determines that you should run, then you're going to get paid at least that amount.
Does the market in this type of tariff, does the market determining that you have to run relate to any sort of the technical components of the market or the needs like spinning reserves, all that sort of stuff, voltage support, those sorts of characteristics, or is this just strictly we need this much to meet demand?
So it looks at energy, and it also looks at spinning reserve, supplemental reserve, and regulating reserve, and those are all co-optimized. And so the revenues as well as the cost for those products are also included in this calculation. And so the market clearing engine tries to minimize the overall production cost of the system by adding up all the startup costs, no load costs, energy costs. And it also, as part of that, tries to also minimize the make-whole payments. So that means that it will, if there's a unit that only needs to run for 1 hour but might be more expensive, the clearing engine might choose that unit over a slightly cheaper unit that might have to run for 8 hours.
Okay.
It's a complicated algorithm, but it tries to maximize the production costs and minimize unneeded make-whole payments. So most of the time, if there's make-whole payments in the day-ahead market, those might be $2 or $3 or $4 per megawatt hour. So there's always a few units on the margin that maybe would run and could make a couple dollars versus resources that maybe couldn't run and are foregoing a couple dollars.
So in this chart, the large section that has the month by month, what year is that?
This is for 2018.
And then what's this bar over on the three bars on the right?
The three bars on the right compares the total for 2016, the total for 2017, and the total for 2018.
And I see. Okay.
Yeah. And then it's broken down by fuel type. So coal gets about 25% of the make-whole payments, and then combined cycle natural gas gets about another 15%, and then the remainder goes to simple cycle gas.
I'm surprised that the simple cycle gas gets so much. Should I be? Or is that just because it's peaking?
Some of it is because it's peaking, and it sometimes they have longer min run times than what the market actually needs it for. So the market might only need that resource for an hour, but because there's no other resources, it has to go and look at the three-hour resources or the five-hour resources in order to meet that peak hour.
All right.
So real-time make-whole payments, we also look at those. So a lot more of that tends to fall on the gas simple cycle units. And then most of the other that you see here is oil. So we still see a few, some small amounts of coal, then have some simple cycle natural gas, and then some, quite a bit of it's the simple cycle natural gas. So, but again, you know, these numbers are, you know, still overall over the course of the year, it's about 10 cents per megawatt hour for the day ahead market costs, and then about less than a dollar for the real-time market costs. So there's still a very small amount of costs overall. Mm-hmm. And most of the real-time make-whole costs, those are mostly allocated to people that were either short on their forecast, and so they have to buy more in the real-time, or you know, if a generator has a trip problem, it has to buy back its real-time position, but then also it has to pay for some of the make-whole payments. So the real-time make-whole payments are try to be allocated to just people who are off of their day-ahead positions to try to follow the cost-causer principle.
Sure. What about the day-ahead ones?
The day-ahead ones, all the load pays for those, and then the virtuals also pay for some of those. But it equates to about 8 to 10 cents per megawatt hour for each megawatt hour load. Mm-hmm. So one issue we're trying to work on is the wind. There tends to be more wind that shows up in the day in the real-time market than is cleared in the day-ahead market, and so that leads to price divergence and is one of the drivers for the real-time make-whole payments. So have about 1,000 megawatts of wind that shows up in the real-time that was not cleared in the day-ahead market. And so part of that is there's a risk uncertainty factor that people are not real comfortable that all their wind is going to actually show up, so they're a little reluctant to offer. Some of that is some market participants, because they get a production tax credit, don't participate in the day-ahead market. And also some of the rules do not hold wind to the same types of regulatory rules for physical withholding that all other resources are subject to. And that was kind of one of our recommendations that is going to be included in the HIT team, is to look at some of these rules around wind, because while it might make sense if wind is only 3 or 4% of the portfolio to exempt them from physical withholding, when wind is 25% and on some days 50% of the resources, you know, they need to have be on a similar playing field to other resources in terms of not just be giving a carte blanche exemption from certain regulatory processes.
And what's physical withholding?
So physical withholding is if I don't offer my resource over here and I have 10 other resources over here, I raise the price, and because I have 10 other resources over here, I make a lot more money than if I would have offered this resource at its expected amount. And it also has some risk of, you know, the wind could all decide not to offer one day, and that would be a problem to the market as a whole. So fortunately, they're generally incented to offer because the load always tries to buy its requirements in the day ahead. So, but that's a risk that we see, and we think it's important to try to, you know, have the regulatory construct match the generation that's actually in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. So market-to-market payments, SPP and MISO have processes where they can have the other system relieve some congestion on their system. We see those payments decrease some from 2017 to 2018. One particular flow gate in Missouri was responsible for a large chunk of the make-whole payments in 2017, and the reduction of that after about the first 2 months of 2018. We'd expect the market-to-market payments to go back to around the $10 million to $12 million in 2019. So, because Neosho to Riverton had about $10 million of that total make-whole payments. So.
And why do you expect that to decrease?
Because that transmission line is not going to be as binding as what it was before.
It's not going to what?
It's not going to have as much congestion going forward.
Okay.
And so negative frequency of prices is something else we monitor. So as you can see here, 2015 was in this light purple, 2016 was in this green that's kind of on top of the purple line. And then in 2017, we had even more negative prices, and that was caused by more wind generators being built in areas that didn't really have an output easily. So several projects went into service in early 2018 in northern Oklahoma to help alleviate that. So that's gone down to its previous level. Negative prices in and of themselves indicate that we need less generation on the system in a certain area, or that we should build some load in a certain area. Those two things are obviously longer term in nature, but there is a concern that if you have too much negative prices, then the generators are not going to be able to stay in business. And that is a concern that is out there. So it's good that that's gone down, but it's still something we keep an eye on, and that's led to some recommendations as well, particularly around whether or not we should mitigate uneconomic production, which is selling at a negative price. So transmission congestion rights is something else we monitor. So load is paying for the transmission system. Load generally wants to be able to get the generation from where it is to where it needs to be served. So I have these congestion rights instruments that allow, if there is a price difference or unexpected congestion that's caused by somebody, I have this instrument where I'm paid the difference, and so I become more indifferent to this. So overall, market participants did a pretty good job of hedging their risk. So on this graph, you can see the day-ahead congestion rent, which is the congestion I pay in the day-ahead market, is in the downward direction. Revenue I receive from transmission hedging activities is in the upward direction. So as you can see here, most of the participants are much closer to zero than what they would otherwise be. And so that generally indicates that the hedging market is working effectively. That people are generally able to, especially these large market participants that have a lot of congestion rent, you can see that they're able to be a lot closer to zero, so that indicates that market's working effectively. So some recommendations we included in our annual report deals with limiting market power by looking at rules for parameter changes that are not in dollars. So minimum run times kind of relates to your question about, seems like there's a lot of make-whole payments on the peakers. Is that appropriate or not? And so this relates to, are the physical parameters actually based on what General Electric says for the peaker, or is it just based on some number someone made up or not? So that's looking at rules around that, because the rules in the tariff right now are, there's not a lot of requirement for that to be true. So looking at, should it actually be true or not? Enhancing credit rules for known information. So in PJM, there was an issue with Green Hat that you might be familiar with, where they had accumulated a $400 million negative position that then got allocated to all the other PJM participants. One of the root causes of that is that no one was looking, all the credit assessments were done on a looking back basis, not on a prospective basis. So there's no analysis of how much of these positions getting in the red before any action is taken. And so looking at trying to make sure that same thing doesn't happen in SPP going forward. So we've been working on that, and the credit practice working group's been very involved in that, and I think there'll be some good revisions that are going to come out of that process to help protect all the market participants from that. So that's moving forward nicely. Developing a mechanism or products to pay for capacity to cover uncertainties. So I have a ramping product that's going to be coming into place soon, which will pay people for being able to move their generators up and down. Also, another issue that happens on a system with a lot of wind is the wind generation might disappear 3 hours from now or 4 hours from now, which is a different problem than the typical spinning and supplemental reserves that we carry, which is a generator trips right now. But it's still a problem that you need to kind of deal with. And so this would be looking at developing a product that would pay the generators for being available on 3 hours notice or 4 hours notice or some number to be determined based on a more thorough reliability study, but then have a product that would cover that particular activity. And so again, the idea here is that the generators that can provide that service are getting compensated for providing that service from the marketplace.
Greg, unfortunately, I have a noon meeting, so I have to slip out. And this is like the crux of everything I wanted to talk to you about, regret that. But can I call you separately?
Absolutely, yes. Right. We can certainly set up a follow-up. That.
I mean, I'll be back at 1 for the...
Absolutely.
Thank you. Sorry.
No, that's okay. I should have gone through here. So so looking at, assessing a range of potential outcomes in transmission planning, I think that relates to, what number should we use for natural gas planning? the real answer is probably don't just use one, but look at a variety to make sure you're planning the system for a variety of potential things that might happen when you're buying these 40-year transmission assets. And then looking at regulation mileage price formation, there's some issues around that that have come up that it looks like the people providing regulation are getting a larger bill than what they're actually making in the regulation market. So that's an area that should be improved. Some existing recommendations, reducing the need for self-commitment and addressing the underscheduling of wind, I think is two areas that work continues on. Increasing flexibility to the market, so as wind continues to be a larger part of the portfolio, being able to cover when that moves in different directions, and also specifically, you know, on a given summer day, the load can change from 28,000 megawatts in the morning to 45,000 megawatts at the peak hour in SPP. So there's a lot of ramping that's needed. And are we appropriately compensating units for being able to provide that ramping product? And then there still needs to be some work done on energy storage designs to allow those to be more fully integrated. SPP has made the compliance filing, but there also needs to be some more thorough activities in there. So. And then looking at enhancing the commitment logic. So I don't know if we have another 10 minutes or not, but we can.
Why don't we shoot for 10? We don't get you or the folks from MISO up here that often.
So okay. All right.
Make use of it, and that'll still give people enough time to go.
Okay. Sounds good. So this is a review of some winter weather events from the market standpoint. And we're just trying to make sure here that are we getting the right signals to people to do something, because price can be a very powerful motivator, especially when that price can be very large. So right here we're looking at the real-time prices over the course of several days in which SPP issued a cold weather alert. So these are looking at the coldest days of the year and how the market performed from a reliability standpoint. So here you can see the prices would vary from, you know, very high numbers of $2,100 at real time for at least 1 5-minute interval. And also there's some times where they have negative prices that can be quite low. And a lot of that is due to transmission congestion on these very cold days, because all of a sudden there's a whole bunch more heaters that people find and plug in places that they didn't know they had, but it's hanging out in the attic somewhere. So they plug it in, and demand goes way up. But a lot of these issues you can see are sort of transient in nature, because this blue line still shows the average price for energy. And, you know, while that was a little bit higher than normal, it was still around the $50 to $75 per megawatt hour. So we didn't really see those really, really high prices on a sustained basis. So a lot that tells us that a lot of this is due to transmission congestion. So local issues, particularly around the load centers, is typically what we see for this, which is kind of what you probably would expect on the cold days. We'll also look at the marginal prices during these events. So, and that relates to the cost of electricity or the cost of serving electricity reliably, which also includes if there's a shortage. We also have these scarcity curves that apply additional prices to the generators. So, you know, some days we're having to rely on some oil units, and then we have some scarcity events that lead to even higher prices to incent generators to be available during these particular hours. But again, the average price over the course of the day still was pretty low. One benefit of that is that the transmission system, you know, allows the North Dakota customers, for example, to be served by gas generators in Nebraska that don't have to compete for the same residential heating load that generators in North Dakota might. So it does give some different, you know, it is good for electricity consumers at the transmission system, and it does help keep some of these peaking prices down overall, just as an example. So on slide 40, we're kind of looking at what we call intervals of scarcity. So on any given 5-minute interval, we may not have enough reliability products to accurately hedge against some sort of unforeseen problem. And so we always have enough generation to serve the energy, but we may not have enough to have our full spinning reserve requirement or our full regulating reserve requirement available. And those are reliability services that have to be used to meet the NERC standards, and also those reliability standards which help reduce the risk of a blackout. And so if we're short in a five-minute interval, a large price adder is added in order to appropriately incent people to provide that, and that helps to provide investment signals for various types of peaking plants. So as you can see here, we have these are the five-minute intervals of scarcity. So over the course of the cold weather events, some days had more than others. So in January 18th, you know, we had a lot of scarcity events that first day, and then the second and third day of the event were a bit less. Looking at the 25th through February 1st, again, started seeing it get colder and colder as we got closer and closer to this event. And at the end of this event, SPP was actually in conservative operations and started to have some more reliability issues. And again, on the February 25th, that was also a conservative operations day. So those were days in which the system's more challenging, so we would expect to see higher prices, and it's actually, from the market monitor's perspective, when the high prices correlate to the more challenging operating conditions, that's actually good because that means the right signals are being sent to people. If we don't see that happening, then is anybody going to want to build a new generator? The answer is no, because they're not going to get any money from it, right? So you want to try to see if those investment signals are correlating to when you need the power or not. So that's one thing we're trying to look at here. The February 16th event was actually not a cold weather event in terms of the temperature being unduly low. That was actually due to a number of wind generators started getting ice forming on them, and some unfortunate precipitation started occurring, and so we had several, about 4,000 to 5,000 megawatts of wind that was unavailable on short notice, unanticipated. As that precipitation moved through, the wind started falling off, and that started causing some problems. So that was really more of the generation that was counted on was not available, so that's really why we saw that day. But, and again, you can see that led to some high marginal energy prices that day and some appropriate signals. So overall, I think unplanned fuel outages is something that we look at, and you know, overall in SPP, while there were a few units that had to take outages for natural gas not being available, it was a very small number. So we have about 900 generators overall, and you know, on even during the peak of the February 7th through 9th event, there were still less than 20 generators that had to take outages due to natural gas not being available. I think the utilities here that have natural gas generation, because they peak in the winter, they tend to have a firm service for the natural gas, so it has a much lower risk of being curtailed, whereas there's some units in Nebraska that, you know, they just have one natural gas and it's non-firm in the wintertime, so it may not be available. So, but overall, I think the generators performed pretty well. We didn't have a lot of unforced outages. There's been some polar vortex events in the east that have had a much higher percentage of unplanned outages due to fuel, but ours were pretty low. So overall, people did a good job. But you can see here there were a lot of manual commitments for capacity on those days, and that's where the SPP operation says we don't have enough capacity to meet the peak hour. We need more generators online, and so there's a manually committed. So, as we looked into those, sometimes we found those were actually being committed more for a ramp issue than a real capacity issue. So that's why, you know, we hope that the ramp product, as that's implemented, will help provide revenue for the right thing, which is actually rampable capacity, not just regular capacity. So that's something that, you know, SPP's already recognized and is taking action on. So that's a good news story there. And then here we're talking about manual capacity commitments versus marginal energy prices. So, you know, as you can see here, you know, here we have a lot of manual capacity commitments, but high marginal energy prices. You know, that's a good correlation, which means while we did have to make some manual capacity commitments, there was at least some price incentive to do so. Whereas a couple other days, so for example, you know, we might see on the February 28th, there's a lot of capacity commitments, but we didn't really see a big price signal to do so. So that tells us that, well, what are we really doing here? Well, it's really we need more rampable units online. So, well, maybe we should actually help develop a rampable product so that these generators are being paid appropriately for the right reliability services they're providing. So I think, you know, that problem's already been, is moving forward through the process. well.
That is, and the ramping product, is that what's going to be addressed by the board in July?
Yeah, that's on the board agenda for July. And then after the board approves it, which they probably will because it's gone through the stakeholder process with a lot of votes, it'd be filed at FERC, and then that process can take usually about 6 months or so is a good estimate between the filing time, comments, and before they make a decision. So. But I think you know, the MISO market and the California market already have a ramping product, so the concept's not new. The implementation details are a little bit different, but so it should go through, I would guess. But that's a little bit of forecast, so you know.
That's it for us.
All right.
Thank you.
Appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, likewise. We're really glad to have you here and
glad to be here.
Beautiful summer day, I think.
Yeah.
Victor, did you have any other questions?
Nope.
Commissioner
nope.
Crispin?
Just appreciate SBP coming out, take the time to explain some of this stuff to us. It's helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yep, extremely helpful. So, okay. Again, thank you for your time, and we are going to regather for the MISO meeting at 1 o'clock. For those of you not familiar with the state capitol, there's a great supper club on the main floor. Well, okay, so it's a cafeteria, but are we still recording?